Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity, the spring-breaking Jim Garrity, I might add. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And, Ian, we should also let folks know that we're sponsored today by ZipRecruiter. Right now, Three Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. And, Ian, it wasn't a good day, you would think, yesterday for Republican governors in general in a scandal that ought to humiliate Robert Bentley. Hopefully he's humiliated at this point. He is now out of office. The New York Times story briefly, Governor Robert Bentley resigned Monday. He's from Alabama. His power and popularity, diminished by a sex scandal that staggered the state, brought him to the brink of impeachment and prompted a series of criminal investigations. It was a stunning downfall for the governor, a Republican who acknowledged in March 2016 that he had made sexually charged remarks to his senior political advisor. He says, "I've decided it's time for me to step down as Alabama's governor." Interesting. Ian, that at that time just happened to coincide with potential criminal charges. But the good news for Republican governors is today, courtesy of Morning Consult polling, is that the 10 most popular governors in America, all of them are Republicans. At the very top of the list, Charlie Baker, Massachusetts, Larry Hogan, Maryland, not exactly deep red states there. Then comes North Dakota, Vermont, South Dakota, Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson there. Greg Abbott in Texas is tied for seventh with Bill Haslam. Sandoval, Nevada is at eighth. Utah is ninth. And Nathan Deal in Georgia at 10th. So, Ian, a lot of Republican governors, obviously. A vast majority of the governors are Republicans. So you would expect a lot of them to make the top 10 list. But the most high profile ones, Jerry Brown, Andrew Cuomo on the Democratic side, nowhere to be found among here. So while they might be adored by the media, not so much by the public, at least not compared to these 10 Republicans.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we should add that one of the most disliked, the most disliked is Chris Christie, which is not particularly surprising at this rate. But the third most disliked is Daniel Malloy in Connecticut. And he's the only Democrat, I think, that makes either of the top 10 lists, top 10 approve or disapprove. So it's an interesting split. But what's so striking to me is that you have these governors, you list them, Baker, Hogan, and Scott in Vermont, who are in these blue states, places like Massachusetts or Maryland, often very, very blue, but with extremely high ratings. And that has something to do with the governing style that Baker and Hogan share, which is, A, they're amicable temperamentally, but then they've been focused on sort of coalition governing. You know, they know that they can't be Greg Abbott in Texas, so they've figured out a way to implement conservative-style governance in a state that might not be friendly to them all the time and bring other people on board. So kudos to them for the work they're doing in those states. And obviously, Bentley's fall from grace in Alabama, which has been a long time coming. This is a scandal that's been sort of unraveling in slow motion for 13 months, is a further blow to the integrity of the party. But a lieutenant governor takes over that, by my understanding, is respected and will hopefully work to overcome some of the difficulties that have swamped the state over the past year as that scandal has unraveled. And meanwhile, you look across the nation and it is a good day for Republican governors and probably with room to improve for a number of these folks.
How'd you like to be the 9 governors across America who have worse approval ratings than Bentley? when this poll was taken, he was at 44% approval, 48% disapproval. So double good. I think we're glad Bentley's gone, and I think we're glad that Republicans are the most popular. So let's move on to the bad martini now. And Ian, let's talk about a story that no one's been talking about. And that's the story that happened over the weekend with United Airlines. I don't know if you've heard anything about this.
You have to jog my memory. This doesn't sound, yeah.
Not ringing a bell? Yeah, it was a flight. They overbooked it. So they asked for 4 people to give up their seats. They offered $400 vouchers. Nobody took it. and they offered $800 vouchers. Nobody took it. United says they offered up to 1,000 and nobody took it. I haven't seen that anywhere else, but I guess we can maybe take their word for that. Still, nobody took it, regardless of what the top offer was. So then they just decided to randomly start removing people. And three people reluctantly agreed to go. And then there was a doc said he had patients that he had to get to Monday morning, and so he couldn't give up his seat. That then led to this.
Can't they rent a car for the pilots and have them drive?
Ah!
So what they did to him was yank him out of his seat quite violently so that they yanked him across the aisle and hit his head on the armrest. He was bleeding in some later photos. Asian gentleman, and he apparently was complaining that he thought he was being singled out for being Asian. In addition to the fact that you can't get away with this anymore without it going viral, Ian, the response from United is, let's just say, less than what a lot of people expected. Oscar Munoz is the CEO of United Airlines. His statement yesterday: this is an upsetting event to all of us here at United. I apologize for having to reaccommodate these customers. Our team is moving with a sense of urgency to work with the authorities and conduct our own detailed review of what happened. We're also reaching out to this passenger to talk directly to him and further address and resolve this situation. According to the New York Times, United spokesman Charlie Hobart said in a telephone interview Monday that, quote, "We had asked several times politely for the man to give up his seat before force was used. We had a customer who refused to leave the aircraft. We have a number of customers on board that aircraft, and they want to get to their destination on time and safely. And we want to work to get them there. Since that customer refused to leave the aircraft, we had to call the police, and they came on board." So, Ian, what a lot of people have learned in the last 24 to 48 hours is that the airline does have the right to bump you if they want to, since it's their property. Apparently, it's in the fine print of the contracts. But I think a lot of people are shocked at the casualness of the written response and the violence of the physical response.
Right. So I'm going to keep my remarks about this brief, since you can go pretty much anywhere on the internet today and find just takes of varying degrees of warmth. And, you know, everything from "this is the problem with capitalism" to, you know, this is obvious racism. You know, you can find any single interpretation of this incident that you want to find out there. So I'm just going to say briefly, what happened to just behaving with common sense? If you're this doctor, why don't you say, "I'm a doctor. I have patients that I need to get home to urgently." Maybe that's the case. You know, is there any way that someone else could give up the seat? Can we come to, you know, some sort of accommodation? Why don't you try and express this first? If you're the airline, I recognize apparently there are some sort of regulatory caps in place about how much you can offer incentive-wise. But maybe the solution is, look, we have this very stubborn passenger. We will go to the max for anybody else. Is anybody else willing to leave this, you know, to leave this flight? It seems to me that there's a whole lot of space between we overbooked this flight and need to create four seats to dragging someone down the aisle and on the passenger side screaming as it happens. It strikes me that we increasingly see this in a whole variety of venues and situations where the first response of everyone, you see this in many of the interactions between people and police over the past couple of years, the first reaction of everyone on either side is to get tense and to escalate. There are a whole lot of reasons for that, I suspect. But it strikes me that one of the most salutary things we can do just as a society in general is lower the temperature on almost every face-to-face interaction, and you'll avoid situations like this one.
I did read somewhere, Ian, that he did try to tell the flight crew or the gate agent, I don't know who was the one trying to tell him to leave, that he was a doctor and had patients in the morning, but I don't know if there's a language barrier or what happened there, but it's just a shame there's a caps because on the incentives, because capitalism should have solved this, right? If you go high enough, somebody's going to want to give up their seat. If you go to 1200, 1500, whatever it is, somebody's got a price. If you offer someone enough money and you give them incentive to give up their seat, eventually you'll avoid situations like this. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the regulatory situation here, I don't know much about, but my assumption is that this was an instance of regulatory capture. So in this case, the airline was looking at the situation and saying, okay, but if what we do, if we do what you just suggested, Mr. Corumbos, then someone, you know, will just play the system and keep bidding us higher. So, you know, somebody will figure out, oh, well, I actually want $10,000 instead of the $5,000 that you're offering, and they'll stay seated. And, you know, you'll just have this sort of constant extortion happening. It's in the airline's best interest to have the government back them and say we can only go up this high, you know, and after that point, you know, we can't exercise force because, look, the government says this is all we can do. You know, in fact, that is in the airline's best interest, not in the customers. On the flip side of this, though, and maybe this is a reason to reconsider that this particular instance of regulatory capture, easily United has earned tens of millions of dollars in negative media through this incident. And of course, their stocks opened down $730 million this morning. So, you know, on the balance sheets, maybe that cap is not actually saving them money after all.
All of a sudden, $1,500 doesn't look too bad. $730 million on the other side.
Exactly. You buy this guy several Malibu apartments, and they'll still be saving a bundle.
My favorite response on this was actually from a family member of mine who said, "Pepsi colon, nobody can put together a PR nightmare like us." And then United colon, hold my beer.
That's exactly right. If you're in corporate PR this week, hope you're learning something.
This is going to be in some training sessions, I think, regardless of whether you work for United or not. But, you know, do you run an airline? Do you run another business where you would prefer that your employees not drag people out of places unconscious or have better demeanor to reach an amicable settlement? Or are you hiring in general? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Because posting your job in one place is not enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200 plus job sites. 200 all at once, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with just a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates just roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies, as well as thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. It works great. It saves time. It streamlines things for everyone, regardless of the size of your business. And right now, Three Martini Lunch listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. So, Ian, if capitalism doesn't work to solve events like what happened on the United Airlines flight a couple of days ago, perhaps Oregon is moving closer to a different way to resolve these sorts of things. This is courtesy of Jazz Shaw over at Hot Air, as well as the Associated Press. Are we close to seeing a return of formal dueling at 10 paces in Oregon in the next few years? That's the fun interpretation when you see a headline such as this one in the Associated Press. Oregon voters may decide to toss constitutional ban on duels. I'm not immune to the occasional fit of pining for the colonial days, but that sounds a tad bit extreme even to me. But as with most such stories, it turns out to be mostly clickbait, to the great disappointment of many, I'm sure. Now to the Associated Press story. Should ongoing discussions in Salem materialize, voters would see a question on their general election ballots asking if a 172-year-old ban on dueling by public officials as in the old-fashioned way of resolving fights, should be erased from the Oregon Constitution. And basically it goes on to say that this is mainly a way of cleaning out old laws that have no need anymore, and that obviously there's still laws against shooting people, so you really don't need the dueling law anymore. Ian, in the age of Twitter, I'm not sure that legalizing dueling would be the greatest idea, but it might perhaps ratchet things down. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not at all opposed to giving these things a try. This is, in fact, Greg, I mean, I think that you could make the case that this is the type of true conservatism that we need, you know, really, really going back, really going, you know, to the origins of things, even before, you know, Oregon's constitution. It's a conservatism of spirit, if not necessarily of letter. No, it's a fun story, of course. I agree with what Jazz goes on to suggest in that post, which is that, in fact, if we do want to talk about a true conservatism, there might be something, it might be worth hitting the brakes before stripping out old lines in the constitutions. Maybe there are reasons for odd provisos and strange clauses that don't, on the surface, make sense to us today, but have a broader application or a broader, you had an intent behind them that is still very much with us. So these states that are like Oregon that are trying to clean up their constitutions might want to be careful in case they throw out some baby with some bathwater.
Could be the case. I think this might just be the premise for Hamilton too, because they don't they don't like the way the first one ended necessarily. Ian, thanks for filling in today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Sounds good, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and be sure to visit our friends at ZipRecruiter, ziprecruiter.com/freetrial. Join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.